at
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, April 13th, 2026. Welcome to the program, and we're glad you're here to listen to us today. My name is Magnus Teevil. Joining me in the studio today are...
Peter R.H.
Stephen Fan.
And we got a whole bunch of stuff lined up for you today. We're going to start off with a report about the gondola. The gondola they're planning to... putting up from... the SkyTrain up to the top of Burnaby Mountain. There was a rally last week to try and move that process along, and our reporter Danny Nesvadarani was there. We're going to talk a little bit about the U.S.-Israel-Iran war and a particular aspect of that, the sort of way Iran is working around
dollar sanctions regime.
And how that's actually pretty significant. We also have a report about a documentary about the struggles of the Nachako River and indigenous folks in that region, brought to us by Pamela Hasen from the friends at Smithers Radio. Of course, we have Gardening with Embark and Bird Note and some other reports. What are you going to be talking about, Peter?
Well, how the CIA created abstract expressionism.
All right. So we got all that and more coming up on the show today. Don't forget, and a lot more coming up on CGSF today, too. But first, we're going to get to our story from Danny Nesvadarani.
I think the CIA in abstract expression.
Feels the depths of hidden homelessness throughout the city. One key difference, Woodland says, is that this is the first accounting of people living in spaces, like an emergency shelter, transitioning home, or a car. In years previously, they were only counting those unsheltered in a public space or an encampment.
And so that piece around people living in vehicles, couch surfing, staying with relatives, you know, they might have somewhere that's got a roof over it, but it's not a permanent, long-term, sustainable place for somebody to stay. And so that's what hidden homelessness is.
The 2025 PIC count found 31% of those surveyed living in a type of homeless shelter, 9% living in a vehicle, and 7% living in transitional housing. The remaining 51% were found living in an encampment or an unsheltered public space. While the count normally happens every 2 years, Woodland explains that as they are funded by the government of Canada, the government has asked them to run enumeration counts as a way to check in on past year's numbers. An enumeration count works the same way as a regular count, but has a short survey for community members and collects less data from participants. For the first time, they also counted youth, people 24 years old and under, that were identified as unhoused. In the count, they identified 54 homeless youth with hidden or informal arrangements, such as staying at a hotel or motel, as their most common form of shelter. Factoring hidden homelessness and youth into the count, Woodland says was driven by community partners, such as the City of Nanaimo, Sinaimuk First Nations, and other local nonprofit organizations.
And it was actually at the direction of those partners that we started to include these other areas of data that honestly, most of those operators have known that that's a critical part of our understanding of homelessness locally, but it hasn't quite made it to those official survey points or data points. So it was community driven.
They say this is something they'll continue to survey during all future PIC counts. The 2025 numbers of 577 people found unhoused is a decrease from 2024, which found 621 people unhoused. But Woodland says this year's numbers should be taken as a bare minimum for the number of those living unhoused in the city, and that the true scale of homelessness is still very high.
This is a 24-hour period. It depends on who shows up on the day, who we can find, who's willing to kind of participate. And so all of those things are massive variables that makes a point in time count. It's useful as a kind of snapshot. But is it an actual real count of every single person that's experiencing homelessness within a community? Not necessarily.
Woodland says homelessness is a complex social issue. And since the COVID-19 pandemic, they have seen an explosion in the number of people experiencing housing precarity.
And ask anybody that's earning a minimum wage or a low income or even middle income folks, you know, the cost of living and the cost of housing has just gone up exponentially. And the statistics across Canada show that a significant number of families are two or three paychecks away from insecure housing. So I think I would just ask the community of Nanaimo to really consider that this could happen to anybody at any point in time. And I think we'd all want to make sure that there was a really solid safety net to help any of us or our friends and family if we found ourselves in those situations. And we are quite challenged with empathy right now because there are so many things happening in so many corners of the world. But really on our doorstep, there are lots of folks that need support and help, and anything we can do to support our own community is well received.
They say that people tend to look at the overall number of those unhoused. And while the 577 people counted is lower than the previous year, the need of support is not. The next point in time count is set to be conducted later this fall. For C2I News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Outside of Simon Fraser University's Student Union building, a rally took place to advocate for a project that has long been discussed, the Burnaby Mountain Gondola. The rally was a collaboration between the Simon Fraser Student Society and local transit advocacy group Movement YVR. It was in 2014 when the TransLink Mayor's Council developed a 10-year vision for Metro Vancouver transit and transportation that highlighted the need for a high-capacity connection from Burnaby Mountain to a nearby SkyTrain station. Simon Fraser University's location on Burnaby Mountain has made it difficult to access for many, especially during snowy conditions in the winter, where it's common for buses to struggle to drive up the mountain. The Burnaby Mountain Gondola Project has been a topic of major discussion among the SFU and Greater Burnaby communities for over a decade, and students gathered to express not only their support for the project, but their frustrations around the time it's taken for its construction to start. At the rally, we spoke with Dennis Agar, Executive Director of Movement YVR, and asked him why his organization decided to join the Simon Fraser Student Society for this rally.
We're here to let the province know that we want a gondola to SFU. It's very rare that we get the opportunity to save people like 40 minutes in their day, right? Like the bus is like around a half hour plus, depending on how long you're waiting. The gondola will be 6 minutes and it will be just always coming. Like there's going to be no wait time. It's a remarkable time savings for people that have to do mega commutes into SFU. You know, it's so expensive to find housing near campus. And on top of that, now it's so much more expensive to drive with the price of gas exploding. And so we need relief. We need the government to take action, do what it can do to make life more affordable for SFU students.
Burnaby City Councilor Daniel Tatro was also in attendance to express his support for the gondola project.
I've experienced what it's like firsthand being a former SFU student to take the R5, or what I think it was the 135 when I was a student here. Shows you my age maybe. And coming out of class and seeing, you know, big snowfall and being stranded up in the mountain. It's not fun, and it happened often. And so the SFU student community, staff up here, and also the growing city of university needs reliable, efficient public transportation, and the gondola seems to meet those needs. So the city of Burnaby, myself and my council colleagues have endorsed the gondola project years ago, actually, and so right now the last hurdle is just getting that funding. And you know, myself and my colleagues will continue to advocate for better or more funding in transit, but particularly the gondola project, so it gets past that final hurdle and gets built.
Lastly, we spoke with Arden English, a third-year SFU student, as well as a member of Movement YVR, who gave some background on why he believes the gondola project has taken as long as it has.
Right now, when you ask TransLink about the Burnaby Mountain Gondola, they'll come out with the answer saying that they're waiting to finish the business case. And now, this isn't the first business case that's been done for this project. There was one, I believe, back in 2011 that was completed for the project, back when the estimated cost was $120 million that we could have jumped on and built, 15 years ago. But now we have to redo the project because the cost of, or the business case, because the costs have changed. And while we don't know the current outcome of that business case, we need to make sure that the work that is going on behind the scenes is being done with the experts that have the in-house expertise from cities like Mexico City, Toulouse, France, that build 3S urban gondolas like this to inform this business case. Because without that level of in-house expertise, it's really just a bunch of consultants coming around that don't properly know what they're doing and might cost this way more than is reasonable.
And yeah, what can students who want to advocate for this project, what can they do, or what do you suggest they do?
The first thing by far is be informed. And I think if you're listening to this, it's a great step in the right direction. But the main course of action is to reach out to your MLA and your MP. MLA is your provincial representative. Your MP is your federal representative. Where you live, your riding, you can very easily look up on the internet. Say you live in Burnaby Heights. You look up Burnaby Heights MLA, it'll show you the name of your riding, that location, and it'll give you the email address to reach out to. And simply write a simple email. Say you're a student at SFU or a resident of Burnaby, or both. If you're a proper resident here, that holds a lot more weight because those are your local representatives. But tell them that this is a problem that needs solving. It's very common for the electeds to get caught up in all the different issues that are happening around the province and around the country, that what is a much smaller scale project like this can kind of fly under the radar. And it's just about making sure that they're always thinking about it in the back of their mind.
This has been Danny Nesvararani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF. Thanks to Danny for that. The war in the Middle East is,
is it happening? Is there a ceasefire? What's the ontological status of a ceasefire?
It is hard to tell what really is sort of going on. There were negotiations starting on Friday over the weekend, which apparently did not work. Well,
I saw this really funny comment, and
okay,
it's like 0.1% on PC, but the joke was, you know, like J.D. Vance went to Islamabad in Pakistan, and essentially he did exactly follow the rule book on negotiating with a Persian rug seller, which is final price, walk out. And that's exactly what he did. He's like, these are our terms, we're not negotiating them. He walks out, flies out in a huff. And it's a little bit on PC, but I think it's taking the right generous spirit. It's okay. But that was the
yeah.
The
so they did say that supposedly there were some fruitful discussions, but now the United States is blockading the Straits of
Hormuz. I saw that.
It's blockading like the entire, from what I understand, the entire Iranian coastline.
It's there is a purpose to it, but also it just brings to mind that meme about from like the movie In Bruges, where like the guy is trying to hold a gun to the other guy's head, but the other guy is suicidal, so he's holding a gun to his own head. And so I'm just like, this kind of describes this situation.
Or perhaps the Spider-Man meme. Pointing at each other.
We're now speaking in memes. We're meme converse and meme literate.
That's how we run wars writ. Now. We're just running with memes.
It does serve a purpose in the sense that Iran, who effectively has been controlling the Strait of Hormuz, has been letting through its own oil through and therefore earning revenue and not, you know, Saudi Arabia or whatever. The United States is like, we're going to take away your revenue. But of course, then you just think about hypotheticals here. Like, let's say the Chinese Navy escorts a Chinese tanker full of Iranian oil through the strait. Is the U.S. Navy going to shoot on the Chinese Navy? I don't think so.
No.
You know, especially with the big summit between Trump and Xi coming up in a month, right? Like, it's just, the whole situation is absurd. Like, it's not sustainable.
Yeah. But you wanted to highlight a different aspect of what's going on, which is, of course, one of the things we've heard about is how Iran is taking payments for some of the ships they're allowing through. And the way they're doing that is using...
They're accepting RMB, which is the Chinese currency.
Cryptocurrency.
But also cryptocurrency, stable coins especially. Yeah. So I think this is really interesting. And I think this is kind of gets at something much bigger than the Iran war and than the sanction invasion. And I get to that point very quickly, which is that for a long time, crypto has been a technology without a use case. Like it's a solution looking for an answer. I mean, solution looking for a question. Yeah. But this is the question. You have a situation where the dollar system is hegemonic. The entire world trade runs on the dollar system. And there's a question, you know, as Chinese and Indian and other growing economies get bigger and bigger, what's the status of the dollar going forward? And always the answer has been that the dollar will not be supplanted because these developing world currencies, chiefly right now the RMB, but also eventually Indian and Indonesian and other currencies, they don't have the desire to replace the dollar in the sense that China does not want its currencies to be used in third-party international financial and global trade transactions unrelated to China, because that would mean essentially a higher valuation of RMB that harms their exports. That's the most basic case. They want a manufacturing export economy.
Not being the world a currency allows them to sort of control their currency and its value in a way that's beneficial to them.
Yeah, it allows them to have capital
control. It doesn't have giant knock-on influences on the rest of the world economy, which could also hurt them, be at odds with what they're trying to do.
China's absolutely committed to capital controls. You absolutely cannot have a world currency with capital controls. That being said, so the conclusion drawn from that, the corollary has always been that the dollar will continue to be the reserve currency because there's no viable alternative. But now there's a really interesting, fascinating case here. What if cryptocurrency is the international of the RMB, of the developing world currencies, in the sense that you have the dollar occupying the old order, the new currencies, which don't want to take the status of the dollar, but ultimately you're trying to solve a question of what is the currency for global trade and commerce and finance? Or one of the currencies, or one of the ways, one of the mediums in which this transacts, because I don't think it will be replaced by a single thing, but it will be potentially joined by a plethora of things. Mm-hmm. And you can see this already happening. You can see the way the gold price has, you know, like gone up insane amounts in the past couple of years. In a way, other things have gone up. Yeah, there's Bitcoin and other things, but I think the future of the global monetary order is not necessarily one dominated just by the dollar or by the RMB, but by a variety of things. Gold, Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. Right now, Iran is accepting stable coins. So stable coins are coins pegged to real-world currencies, chiefly the U.S. dollar. Yeah. So they're not deviating from the value.
They're
of
not fluctuating like Bitcoin does. Or
And part of it is that traditionally crypto people have been just insane gold bugs, anti-inflation, so they don't really have proper monetary mechanisms either. But eventually that's going to change. Yeah. And I think the question that's kind of arises out of this is, you know, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State for the United States, summed it up best. He's saying that in 5 years, everyone's going to be using stuff that's not the dollar. So the U.S. ability to sanction foreign banks using the U.S. dollar will be diminished because people will be using stuff other than the dollar. And yeah. I think he's exaggerating for effect and to kind of argue his case, but also there is some merit to it. You know, like, I think the future of the world monetary order is going to be a very much more diverse and uncertain and fractured one compared to one before. And this is kind of a beginning signal of that.
Well, it's interesting how, you know, the United States seems, and we're not going to get into this topic, but, you know, seems to have gone into this a bit, this war a bit rushed into it without really thinking through a lot of the implications. Like, they didn't quite expect Iran would block the Strait of Hormuz, although that's sort of an obvious response, and stuff like this, where it's, you know, pushing, you know, showing up different alternatives to the way the world has worked.
I do want to make a comment on this very briefly, which is that as a Canadian person, as a Canadian national, I do try and keep some emotional distance from this. You know, I do consider this potentially a blunder, but I think the habits of a lot of Canadians to kind of take these events in American politics very personally, that is very detrimental to Canadian sovereignty. So I say, like, yeah, this is not probably well advised, but I try and keep an emotional distance from it, and I say, no, let's see what happens in the global order as a result of it.
It was either capital control or capital gains. You'd said this a bit back.
Capital controls.
What exactly is that?
It's the movement.
You've got to be quick because we're running out of time.
Yeah, 5 seconds. Capital control is the control on movement in and out of a country. That's the definition of capital controls.
And that's what the United States dollar has.
It does not. Because the United States has global capital controls. Capital control, effectively, but capital controls conventionally refer to controls on capital movement across national borders.
Which cryptocurrencies wouldn't have.
Exactly.
Okay, just want to have that clarified.
All right, thanks for that, Stephen.
No worries.
And now on, we have a report about a documentary about the struggles of Indigenous folks in the Chaco River community.
As communities across northern British Columbia continue to grapple with the long-term impacts of industrial development on land and water, the story of the Nachako River has become a powerful focal point for questions of stewardship, sovereignty, and justice. The documentary Nachako, It Will Be a Big River Again, brings these issues into sharp focus, tracing the decades-long efforts of the Saikas First Nations and the Stlatin First Nation to restore a river system profoundly altered by the construction of the Kenny Dam and the diversion of its waters for industrial use. At the heart of the film is not only an environmental story, but a legal and political one, anchored in the landmark Saikas First Nation and Stlatin First Nation versus Rio Tinto Alcan Incorporated, a case heard by the Supreme Court of British Columbia. The decision marked a significant moment in Canadian law, recognizing that First Nations could advance claims for damages related to the destruction of fisheries, which is a critical step in asserting Indigenous rights and title in the context of resource extraction. In this interview, we hear from Liana Patrick, the film's writer and director, as well as Jasmine Thomas, associate producer and stewardship and reconciliation lead for Saikas First Nation. The documentary Nachako, It Will Be a Big River Again, is playing at the Old Church in Smithers on April 19th at 7 p.m. It is hosted by What Matters in Our Valley.
Hi, I'm Jasmine Thomas. I am a member of Saikas First Nation Nufka Iwaten Frog Clan, and I am currently acting as the Stewardship and Reconciliation Lead for the Nation and participated as the Associate Producer on the Nachako film.
Hi, I'm Liana Patrick, and I'm a member of the Stlatin First Nation, Frog Clan as well, and I'm also Acadian and Scottish, and I am a professor in the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University as well, and I'm the writer and director of Nachako.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. How did the landscape and communities of the Nachako region, how did they shape the storytelling approach, but also visual language of this documentary for you?
I grew up mostly in Jasmine's territory, actually, in Saika's territory. And we lived, you know, meters away from the Nachako River. And as I was invited to be a part of this film, you know, it was an area that obviously is near and dear to my heart, having my family there, having grown up around near the Nachako. But I realized there was so much that I didn't know about the territory, that I didn't know about the river. There was a lot I did and a lot I didn't know. So, you know, as I was meeting people and getting to know, you know, understand what the story was going to be about, I think all of us realized, like, you know, the central role, like the center of the heart of the story is the river, you know, and efforts of community of Jasmine and many others over the many years to save the river and restore it and protect it. So, you know, the river, the landscape, the impacts, all of that, the impacts of resource extraction, of colonial policies and what continues to happen, those, you know, that was a big part of the story.
So thinking of the Nachako, definitely think of, you know, the major connections to, you know, being one of the largest tributaries to the Fraser River and growing up in between Tsleil-Waututh Tene territory and Saika's in the Van Derrif and Prince George region. You really get to build that relationship with not only the rivers themselves, but within the entire Nachako watershed, which comprises about one-fifth of the province of BC in terms of, you know, land base and scale. So when we're looking at a project such as the Kenny Dam and the reservoir associated with that development, it really impacted an entire region, about one-fifth of the province. And then beyond that, the interconnected river systems of, you know, this province and the food sources that not only our region depends upon, but where they go up to spawn to, you know, the headwater areas of, you know, Takla, Lake First Nation and others, and down to, you know, the Pacific. So I think, you know, making those connections in terms of impact, but also in terms of sustenance and the different connected systems really played a role in terms of positioning where I see myself as a Yinka Dene woman, as a Saika's woman within the broader Nachako watershed, but within these interconnected systems.
So how did you navigate and sort of find that balance between telling a very legal story, but also a deeply personal story to the nation members involved?
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. It was a daunting challenge at first to think about how to tell this story, because it's many, many stories, and it's a very long history. But you know, we were Lantern Films, and the one of the producers, Jessica Hallenbeck, was approached by Saika's, by the nation, to make this film. And it was happening at a time when the court case was happening. And I think that arguments were getting, they were preparing arguments for the Supreme Court, the BC Supreme Court. And so the time was right to really tell that story. And this court case was really significant. And really precedent setting in a number of ways. And so, and the communities, you know, Tsleil-Waututh and Saika's, they came together and, you know, agreed that this was something they wanted to tell. So we kind of started looking at the court case as like the backbone, you know, a way of like connecting all these different pieces. And then, you know, through lots of meetings in community, through, being able to get access to a lot of the archives and those materials, especially recordings of elders and these interviews that have been done from like the, you know, early 80s, We were able to sort of, you know, really situate this story along kind of a historical continuum, but also have it really be grounded in really specific voices of folks, you know, that were involved in leadership positions like Chief Archie Patrick and former Chief Jackie Thomas. And of course, Jasmine is a really key part of this story as well. So, you know, we were really fortunate to have folks in community.